Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Is a class war underway in the United States? Or is the war over and we lost? We'll hear dispatches from Noam Chomsky, Nicholas Kristof, and others. I hope you'll stay tuned. Well, I had thought of calling this installment Potpourri Number 4. But looking back over my basket of odds and ends, I see a common theme to this week's assortment. And that theme is class war, so to speak. Maybe the idea came from hearing so much of George Carlin on our show 2 and 3 weeks back. Carlin talks a lot about class conflict. He also notes that when we talk about fixing social problems, the only metaphor we use is war. So we have the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on obesity, the war on crime. So the phrase class war pops into my mind. I don't really like the term class war. Not as a description of reality in America. After all, war implies two sides, each aware of who the enemy is, each actually fighting the other. I don't see class war going on. I see class victory, conquest, occupation, and rule. That is, the victory, conquest, occupation, and rule by the 1% of the 99%. As Chris Hedges said, they won. The 1% now controls all three branches of government, the media, all the means of production, agriculture, the universities, the clergy, you name it. Of course, nonviolent resistance is still possible and might do some good. Hedges says nonviolent resistance is imperative. The occupied always find ways of resisting their occupiers. Sometimes they even overthrow the occupiers, as Gandhi's India did against England. And before that, as the Irish also did against England. Not so non-violently in that case. But resistance is not the same as war. Resistance is all you can do after you've lost the war and other people are running your country. But since the term is in common use, and I can't think of a better one, we'll talk about class war in America. Speaking of George Carlin, he was one of the few popular entertainers to recognize that America does have a class system, and that those few at the top have more freedom and more power, not to mention money, than us working stiffs below. Let me repeat 20 seconds of a routine we heard 2 weeks ago. Here is George Carlin's wonderfully succinct explanation of the class system in America.
You know how I describe the economic and social classes in this country? The upper class keeps all of the money, pays none of the taxes. The middle class pays all of the taxes, does all of the work. The poor are there just to scare the shit out of the middle class. Keep them showing up at those jobs.
And to follow up, here's a nice essay by Paul Burkhardt. This was published in February 2015 in Common Dreams Online. It's titled, Four Numbers to Make Us Fighting Mad, and One Way to Fight. I've edited it a bit for radio. Paul Burkhardt says, if revolution is to happen, Americans must be made aware of the destructive failures of the free market system. We must be angry enough to act. And we must agree on a single demand to make of the people with money and power. The people who have perversely redistributed our national wealth. First, some maddening facts. Fact number one. For every $1 billion of new stock market wealth, most of us gained $1. In the 6 years since the recession, the stock market has risen by $8 trillion, the great majority of it going to the richest 10%. In 2013 alone, the market rose by $5 trillion. Each of us in the bottom 90% earned a dollar every time the market went up another billion. Fact number two, each year since the recession, the upper class, that is the richest 10%, the upper class has accumulated enough new wealth to pay the total cost of Social Security 4 times over. Is Social Security too expensive? Not in comparison to the flow of wealth to the upper class. In the 6 years since the recession, these 16 million families of the top 10% have increased their wealth by $4 trillion per year, which is more than 4 times the cost of Social Security. Fact number three, two top polluters, 4 welfare kings, and a long-term tax avoider took enough of our national wealth last year to pay for all of the school lunch and women infant nutrition programs. That would be the 7 individuals heading up Coke Industries, Walmart, and Berkshire Hathaway. In addition to their corporate profits, the 7 moneymakers had personal investment gains that totaled $28 billion last year. That's the total cost for nutrition programs for over 40 million kids. And the top 10% made even more the year before, and the year before that. As these billions in new wealth was rolling in, child nutrition programs were being cut. Fact number four. Then, workers paid 33 cents in tax, corporations paid a dollar. Now, workers pay 33 cents in tax, corporations pay 7 cents. Workers and their pensions get blamed for budget shortfalls. But relative to workers' payroll tax, corporate taxes have dropped from $1 to 7 cents since the 1950s. Meanwhile, corporate profits have reached record highs, more than doubling in just the past 10 years. Paul Burkeit continues, a way to fight. We desperately need a solution to massive upward wealth redistribution. Peter Barnes has proposed one solution that's simple, fair, and proven effective. This is a national permanent fund, much like the popular and successful Alaska Permanent Fund. Corporations have used our resources, research, infrastructure, environment, educational, and legal systems. Corporations have used these to develop technologies that are gradually reducing the need for human involvement. We all contributed to their success, either directly or through our parents and grandparents. We all deserve to benefit from our nation's steadily rising productivity. With an America Permanent Fund, all of us, rich and poor alike, would receive a share, perhaps $5,000 per year. The revenue would come from a carbon tax and or a financial speculation tax and or a redirection of corporate profits away from executive-enriching stock buybacks. An America Permanent Fund is fair, logical, and based on precedent. We will be hearing a lot more about it. So ends this dispatch from Paul Burkeit. And okay, sounds like a long shot getting a proposal like that through the Republican-controlled Congress. Or for that matter, getting it through any Democrat-controlled Congress either. But a similar system has been working for decades in the state of Alaska. In Alaska, A share of the state's oil revenues is distributed to each citizen. And indeed, a plan much like this America Permanent Fund was actually proposed by America's last liberal president, Republican Richard Milhouse Nixon. Nixon called it the negative income tax. It didn't fly, but you've got to give Nixon credit. So, we'll see. They, the 1%, have almost all the wealth, almost all the power, and they control almost all of the communications media. Well, at least we outnumber them. If only we'd learn how to count, we'd realize that. That was a real benefit of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which began fall of 2011, I think. Both the increased awareness of class conflict and also the phrases, the 99% and the 1%. Both of these came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement. 99% and 1%, and one of those numbers is bigger than the other. Here's another take on the theme of class war. It came out of Occupy Wall Street, literally. Here's singer Jonathan Blackshear.
On our liberty, so we'll occupy our cities till we get our country back, and we won't be going home until we get her back on track. When we get what we came for, we'll have only just begun. We want the whole world to realize we are 99 to 1. Ain't like any person that I've seen. Wanna cut out loopholes for the ultra wealthy, while the rest of America lives in poverty. So we'll occupy our cities till we get our country back, and we won't be going home until we get her back on track. When we get what we came for, we'll have only just begun. We want the whole world to realize we are 99 to 1. Well, we're not from the left or right, we're from America. And our issues are not black or white, they are American. We'll not let them divide. We want the whole world to realize we are 99 to 1.
Jonathan Blackshear. On New World Notes, we're hearing Dispatches from the Class War in America. And here is another It's by Nicholas Kristof. Kristof is an establishment liberal. A bit too establishment for my tastes. Pretty much what you'd expect from a columnist for the New York Times. But Kristof often has worthwhile things to say, and he does so here. Published in the Times just a few months back, on April 9, 2015. I've edited it and condensed it a little for radio. Its title is a question. Enjoying the low life? Kristof writes, "The United States is the most powerful colossus in the history of the world. Our nuclear warheads could wipe out the globe. Our enemies tweet on iPhones, and kids worldwide bop to Beyoncé. Yet let's get real. All this hasn't benefited all Americans. A newly released global index finds that America falls short on what matters most, assuring a high quality of life for ordinary citizens. The Social Progress Index for 2015 ranks the United States 16th in the world. We may thump our chests and boast that we are number one, and in some ways we are. Sidebar comment. Yes, we're number one in military expenditures, number one in financial speculation, and number one in percentage of citizens locked up in prison. Back to the text. Kristof continues. We're number one in some ways, but in important ways we lag. The Social Progress Index ranks the United States 30th in life expectancy, 38th in saving children's lives, and a humiliating 55th in women surviving childbirth. We know that we have a high homicide rate, but that's not all. We also have a higher traffic fatality rate than 37 other countries, and a higher suicide rate than 80 other countries. We also rank 32nd in preventing early marriage, 38th in the equality of our education system, 49th in high school enrollment rates, and 87th in cell phone use. Ouch! We're number 87! Doesn't have much of a ring to it, does it? Michael E. Porter is a Harvard Business School professor and an expert on international competitiveness. He helped devise the Social Progress Index. He says that social progress is a critical measure of how a country is serving its people. We are not number one in a lot of stuff that traditionally we have been, he said. The Social Progress Index rated 133 countries. At the top of the list are Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, Iceland, New Zealand, and Canada. Also ahead of the United States are Finland, Denmark, Netherlands, Australia, Britain, Ireland, Austria, Germany, and Japan. Kristof continues, maybe we can learn from countries that have social indicators better than their income levels. For instance, Costa Rica offered free universal primary education in the 19th century. In the 20th century, it disbanded its military forces and invested some of the savings in education. Here's one payoff. Surveys have found Costa Ricans among the happiest people in the world. Interestingly, Professor Porter found only a mild correlation between social progress and economic equality. What mattered much more was poverty. In any case, the 2015 Social Progress Index should serve notice to Americans and to people around the globe. We obsess on the wrong measures, so we often have the wrong priorities. As an American, what saddens me is also that our political system seems unable to rise to the challenges. As Porter notes, Americans generally understand that we face economic impediments, such as declining infrastructure. Yet we're frozen. We appreciate that our education system is a mess, yet we're passive. We can send people to space and turn watches into computers, but we seem incapable of consensus on the issues that matter most to our children. So our political system remains in gridlock, even as other countries pass us by. So ends Nicholas Kristof's piece, titled Enjoying the Low Life. At the end, as a good establishment liberal, Kristof blames us for the problems of the country, as though we had any power to influence public policy. We don't. Not us in the bottom 90%. This is a point made by both George Carlin and Noam Chomsky. Maybe these are two names you don't often hear in the same sentence. Here's a fine short clip featuring Chomsky. He's facing a smug and hostile interviewer on the BBC's program Newsnight, November 26, 2014. Chomsky demolishes the corporate-controlled hack, and he does so with remarkable gentleness and grace, and his usual clarity. Score one for our side. Chomsky's point is that average Americans have suffered substantially from their government's policies, and the policy makers serve only the interests of the upper class. And Americans know it. Here's Noam Chomsky.
Professor, good evening, and thanks for coming in. I wonder whether it annoys you at the moment that the world is rebelling. There's anger out there. The system has been questioned. The elite are unpopular in a way that I think you would encourage. And yet it's not really, the forces are not gathering around your view. In some ways, they're more, it's more right-wing discontent. The Tea Party in the US, the UKIP party here. What do you think?
Those exist, and I think they reflect an understandable anger at a neoliberal period in which the majority of the population has suffered considerably while enormous wealth and power has been accumulated in a tiny fraction of the society. Democratic forms have been substantially reduced. There's plenty of evidence for that. But it's not entirely correct. So, for example, hundreds of thousands of people demonstrated in the streets of New York a couple of weeks ago in calling for serious action about dealing with the climate catastrophe. And that's a representative of a huge part of the population. And I think anger and concern take many different forms, but they have... You can find lots of common roots.
Yeah, and in Spain and Greece, the left wing have come out on top, if you like, of the discontent. But it is, you know, reading those quotes to some ordinary people, it is, I suppose, one of the difficulties of your position, that you end up, in a way, having to take a view of what of you telling them what you think would be good for them, and them not quite really being on your wavelength. Is that a fair critique of the Noam Chomsky philosophy?
That's not my experience. I spend an enormous amount of time giving talks, discussions, all classes of people all over. I don't tell them what to think. I tell them what I think, encourage them to develop their own ideas, and I think we quite often see things the same way.
But when you say people have been made into consumers rather than citizens, is that... Could that be accused of being patronising to people, as though they're kind of suckers for being material consumers, as opposed to thinking bigger things about their lives?
No, I don't. I think they're suffering from a situation in which they are not citizens. They're not participants. It's easy to demonstrate that. I know the United States better, but I think it's essentially the same here. Mm. And one of the major topics in mainstream political science is the relation between attitudes and policy. It's not hard to study. Policy, we see attitudes we determine from very extensive and quite accurate and consistent polling. And the results are striking. It turns out that for about 70% of the population, the lower 70% on the income scale, their attitudes have zero impact on policy. They're just ignored. by their representatives as you move.
That really surprises me, because here I think politicians sometimes feel they're running to catch up with where the public are, particularly on issues like immigration, for example, where they're kind of... It was one they didn't spot, but the public really did.
I'm sorry, but the public has mixed attitudes on immigration. Right. Actually, this is very well studied. Don't take my word for it. In 2 minutes, I can give you references. As you move up the income scale, you get more influence on policy. When you get to the very top, which is a fraction of 1%, you essentially have policy made. This is true on issue after issue. Those that are, whether it's taxes, military, immigration, whatever you like.
It's certainly believable that the sort of more powerful and important people are the ones who run the country.
It's not just powerful, and they're not powerful and important. They control the wealth of the society, and that puts them in a position essentially to purchase the government and its actions. And that's simply demonstrated. In this respect, people are losing the capacity to be citizens.
A brilliant impromptu performance by Noam Chomsky. Wrapping up this week's dispatches from the class war in America. I am Kenneth Doust, and I thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You'll find a free archive of this show at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. There you'll also find my email address, and if you'd care to send me a note, I'd be glad to hear from you. Once again, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimae non carborundum, keep the home fires burning, remember that loose lips sink ships, and please come back again next week. Ciao.